Imagine the kitchen fight from The Raid with the crackling dialogue from A Few Good Men. You can't handle my fist.
Yeah.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
People say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Hello, everybody. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, chat over there in the Patreon land. I don't know what that voice is at all.
I like it, though.
Yeah, it's good. It's very soothing. So today, it's a Recotopia episode 22. Our big recommend is going to be Sorry to Bother You. And how's everybody doing? How's everybody doing out there? Everybody doing
good? I'll tell you
what. Yeah.
I'm upset because I just read the Emmy nominations.
Yeah.
And basically Station 11 got hosed. They gave one nomination for supporting actor in a limited series, but that's it.
Emmy nominations are so weird though. Like you would think Jerry Seinfeld probably won once. I mean, he wasn't a great actor on Seinfeld or anything, but you would have thought that he'd have won once from Seinfeld, and he may not have gotten nominated that much.
It was his supporting cast.
Yeah, Julie Louis-Dreyfus is the one who won a lot, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Emmy nominations are weird. I wouldn't put too much stock in those. I know that everybody wants to be recognized. The problem really might be Emmys might need to expand a little bit. There's so many TV shows at this point.
Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, there's no need to snub everybody. You need to come out with more nominations, I guess. I don't know.
I did see Melanie Lynskey got nominated for Yellowjackets.
There you go. That's
made me happy.
That's someone who should probably win too.
I think she will.
I'm glad to see the chat running like it usually is. Got some familiar faces there, and if you guys want to do that, come and join Patreon and come join us on the live show every once in a while. It's fun stuff, man. And these guys come up with answers when we're flailing. A lot of time.
Yep.
It's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome. Anyway, small recommends today.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Mm-hmm. Small recommends are fun because they're bite-sized little nuggets of goodness.
Indeed.
My first small recommend this week, you may have seen me tweet about it, is the Netflix movie The Sea Beast.
Oh.
This is... the main character is voiced by Carl Urban.
Okay.
And this is directed by one of the co-directors of Moana.
Okay.
This is his first directorial solo debut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will tell you straight up, I had a really good time with this movie, but this is How to Train Your Dragon, Pirates of the Caribbean, with a little bit of Jaws.
Okay.
And... that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that there were many beats that not just I saw coming, but even my wife saw coming. But that's not always a bad thing, especially if you've got young ones. There's a really good message here. There's actually a very anti-capitalism message if you care to dig deep enough. But the real reason I'm recommending this is the animation. It's about sea beasts and pirates, and so there's plenty of time where you know you're watching animation because it's fictional-looking stuff, but there are about 5 establishing shots of nature. Water, trees, that are photorealistic. It gave me shades of The Good Dinosaur, only that movie has nothing enjoyable about it. but I kept saying to my wife, they would cut to a transition shot, and I'd go, that looks real. That looks real.
Hmm.
That looks real. It was incredible animation. So I think you would have a good time. There's so many characters to relate to as well that have an arc. I would say there's three different generations of characters that have a strong arc that you can relate to. So mm-hmm. It's called The Sea Beast. It's on Netflix as of now, and that's my first small recommend.
All right. Like, I think I had run across this before, but I did not know what it was about. And I'm instantly wary of animation that comes from, like, out of Netflix. So I was like, I don't know if I want to watch that or not. Although Mitchell's vs. the Machines was really good, although it was a studio that basically sold their movie to Netflix in that case. So may have to give that a look. I was also on Netflix in the past few days. Ooh. Much darker material here. I will go ahead and give a warning to a lot of people because there's some harrowing events that happen in this, but it's a documentary called Girl in the Picture. It's a crime documentary. And it's one of those where it starts off with something very intriguing. There's a woman who is put in the hospital. The doctors notice that she has a lot of prior injuries on her that have to have been from domestic abuse. And they verified her name as, I can't even remember what the original name was, because as you'll find out, this girl had many names. And she worked as a stripper in this place in Oklahoma. She eventually dies of her injuries in the hospital bed, and her friends at the strip club, find out what her name, you know, knew her name, called who they thought was her mom. And her mom's like, my daughter died 20 years ago when she was an infant and blah, 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 blah. So I don't know what this is all about. So they had to figure out who this person is. And that's what drives this documentary. Of course, we do find out a lot more about her home life. And, you know, she was, her father was abusive sexually and physically to her. She was also very smart. She was headed towards Georgia Tech, education, all this. But the main driver of all this is who was this girl? Because they couldn't find her real identity during this whole thing. Went through various names and just everybody who knew her or something, and she seemed like a totally normal person. But then when the father would enter the picture, she would always get pretty scared and everything. She also had an infant son, that we don't know whether or not it was her father that was the father of that baby or someone else. There's so many different layers to this whole thing. There's so many different things going on in this. Trying to describe this documentary, you have to kind of go through the entire documentary to go through it, you know, like this is, you know, like, you know, this, they had to try, to find this guy because obviously he was like, they believed he killed this kid. They killed his daughter's son. And I'm like making it confusing because it's like there's just so many different things that are going on in this thing. But it's really interesting. Documentaries about this type of stuff usually focus on the killer. This does focus somewhat on the killer, but it focuses on her mainly. And that's one thing that a lot of these documentaries don't do a lot of times, is they'll focus on Ted Bundy, but they won't focus on, like, you know, all the victims of Ted Bundy. Right. And so, this one has a lot of like twists and turns to it. People who dedicated their lives to trying to figure out who she was, where she went, the life of this, the father, the life of her son, like there's never been any verification about what happened to, you know, there through the most of the documentary, you're like, what happened to her son? You know, you just assume that he died. He got killed by this horrible guy, but you know, you don't really know. And he's not very forthcoming about what's happening. So So yeah, it's one of these. It's got a lot of harrowing stuff in it. I am doing a terrible job discussing what it's about. But it
intrigued me.
But it's very intriguing, and in fact, I'm kind of glad I'm not doing a very good job, because you want to find out all the revelations for yourself in this as to who this girl was and why her life was the way she was. So yeah, that was it's really good. It's got a 7.3 on the IMDb, and I don't know if that's a pretty good rating, but it's not like as high as I thought it might be when I take a look. So maybe there's something in there that people aren't responding to in all of this, but
interesting.
But I thought it was very good and intriguing, and it's got a lot of like satisfying twists and turns to it. So
all right. Right on. All right. I have another small recommend that probably everyone has already seen. And I'm surprised to be recommending Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Mm-hmm. Well, this would be the second time, actually, we're recommending this.
You recommended it, right?
Yep.
But I had not seen it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have now seen it, and every now and then it pays to just let a movie come and go and then see it on your own terms. Because this was kind of a divisive movie, at least from the people that I know and follow, because I had people on one side saying, I really hated this. And I had people on the other side saying, this was awesome. There's so much Raimi in this. And I think if I'd seen it right in the midst of all that, I might have been torn to go one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, I think it's probably a solid B, maybe a B+.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really good Raimi stuff in here. And the cameos, I don't want to spoil the small recommends, but the cameos didn't bother me the way they did in No Way Home, because they were cameos and not, we didn't write a third of the story around their appearance. I liked the first Doctor Strange movie. I liked it mostly for the visuals and for what I think is one of the most humorous climaxes, villain defeats of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I was expecting a lot of that Inception-style world folding in on itself visuals this time, and we didn't get a lot of that. There's still some wild visuals.
Mm-hmm.
But I found myself connected, and I think a lot of it has to do with that younger girl character they bring in that he has to sort of protect, who sort of grounds him and makes him a little bit more relatable to me. I liked it. I had a really good time. I would like to watch it again. I liked it way more than I expected to. And there is a sequence in here where Doctor Strange fights a version of himself with music notes, where they use the magic thing to create and throw at each other notes. And then the score is like ding, dong, bong, dong, playing. It's one of the most visually stunning, pleasing sequences I've seen in the entirety of the MCU. It gave me giggle fits. I really, really enjoyed that. And I don't know who came up with that, but that's one of the coolest ideas I've seen. So anyway, if you haven't seen it, if you were holding off because you heard some negative things, I at least endorse The Multiverse of Madness.
Yeah, as I was saying in my small recommend, was that if we are looking for something different in the MCU, we're looking for things that are not the same over and over again. This is the kind of movie that we'd like to see. And I don't know, again, a lot of these directors who came in, they were highly coveted, like Edgar Wright was highly coveted to come in and do Ant-Man and everything, but they didn't have the power to do their own thing. Sam Raimi came in, and I'm thinking maybe Sam Raimi did have the power to do his own thing on this, and they, you know, they kind of let him. He maybe gave a little so that he could take a little, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'll do the things so that you can continue on with your story, but can I do some of my things? And then they're like, yeah, let's do that. So, so yeah, that's I enjoyed this too. I can't wait to see it again myself. So, I was looking around the Criterion Collection the other day, and I watched Bad Day at Black Rock, which is a Spencer Tracy movie. Also stars Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine. It's about Spencer Tracy is let off at a train station that doesn't normally have stops, and that's very weird. Gets stopped in this podunk town just after World War II, and he is unassuming. He looks like any other regular guy, but he shouldn't be here. He's out of place in this town, and everybody who comes up to talk to him is like, why did the train stop here? Why did you stop here? And it's very suspicious. Mm. And he's going around town, and he wants to find a place to stay, and he needs to find a vehicle and all this stuff. And he starts asking around about this Japanese rancher that used to live in the area. And nobody really wants to be forthcoming about what may have happened to this guy. He's pretty sure something bad happened. So Spencer Tracy, you see him throughout trying to first confirm that he can't find this guy and then come back. And what is he going to do about it? And all these people in the town, there's a main villain here who's played by Robert Ryan. He plays a guy named Reno Smith. He is in charge of basically everybody in the town, and a lot of these people just play his, you know, play his ruffians, his, you know, he can send those guys out to kill you if he wants, basically, and everything. And they're getting suspicious, but they don't know exactly what he knows and what he is looking for. So they don't kill him right away, but there's this building up to it. And Spencer Tracy like goes through some of the like most, you know, like very kind of abusive things when he's asking for a room. The hotel manager's like, oh, we keep this open for cowboys and stuff like that who are coming. You can't have a room. But Spencer Tracy ends up kind of taking a key anyway and saying, well, you know, just, you know, I'm going to take this room. That one looks cool. And goes up into the room, and Lee Marvin is like sitting there going, well, this is actually my room. And Spencer Tracy doesn't do anything. Doesn't throw a fit or anything like that. And Ernest Borgnine at one point tries to run him off the road when he's going out into this area, but he still stands firm, doesn't get mean, doesn't do anything. And he doesn't look like he could do anything if he could, right? He's an older gentleman. He's also lost the use of his left arm. This movie is building just like any old Western might, you know, except it's set in the 40s. And you know, we know that there's going to be a showdown of some sort by the end of this. What happened to the Japanese rancher is one of the things, and why everybody's being quiet about it. An interesting kind of a movie back in the 50s. You know, we always think of the 50s as this kind of a time where there's like, you know, they're just so racist or whatever, but there are a lot of like, you know, liberal thinking people back in this day, and they're, and there's a lot of discussion about how Japanese Americans were treated during World War II. A lot of that is maybe not heavily discussed, but it is at least lightly discussed. It's something that I feel like probably hit home pretty hard, even in the 50s, even though it was kind of subtly danced about. This is a really good movie. It's an hour and 20 minutes long. So,
I like those.
So yeah, absolutely. So, give this one a look. It's on Criterion. I don't know if it's on any other services, but it is well worth your time. Really good stuff. Spencer Tracy is just one of those, you know, he's a legend, but, yes. You know, it's just very breezy and good.
Breezy and good.
Mm-hmm.
That's like Ocean Breeze soap.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it's
indeed.
Like taking an ocean cruise, only there's no boat and you don't actually go anywhere.
Yes, is that the beach? Is that the?
It's from the Muppets Take Manhattan.
Oh, okay, I was about to say it sounds like the thing in Seinfeld where they're trying to come up with stuff for the beach, the cologne or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I had forgotten about that. Okay, so. The big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
big one.
Mm-hmm. Is sorry to bother you. This movie, when I first watched it, this is a movie that does require multiple viewings. And at this point, this is probably this past weekend when I watched it, I've probably seen this 3 or 4 times, but I also had it in the background several times during this one night where I just played it on repeat, basically. And I also listened to the commentary by Boots Riley on this, who wrote and directed this. This movie is just, it is completely out there, right, as far as reality is concerned. But it is a satire, and you must watch it as such. And no matter how wild things get, know that there's a point to it, even though it might, by the end of it, you go, oh, what the fuck is this? This has gone completely off the rails. Even though it goes off the rails by the end of it, there is a point to, there's a whole method to the madness, at least to the way I understand it. So, and maybe to some people, it's just weird, whatever. But anyway, let's talk about this. This movie is just a really funny exploration of just, I mean, poverty, essentially. Lakeith Stanfield lives in his uncle's garage with his girlfriend, played by Tessa Thompson, and they can't even make out without the garage door opening and the whole neighborhood seeing them and everything. He owes a lot of money to his uncle, played by Terry Crews, and he's looking for a job. So the job he goes to apply for is this telemarketing service, and he lies about everything that he's done in the past. Looks really good, though. The guy tells him, like, you know, you said that you worked at the Oakland Bank branch in 2014 to 2016. He's like, well, I was the manager of the Oakland branch 2014. He's like, you know what that means? You weren't fucking there. You fucking lied. And so he thinks this might be a deal breaker, right? That he lied so much. And then, but the guy points out, like, because he's made a trophy and he's made this, like, employee of the month plaque and all that. And he's like, you know what? That tells me right there that you've got the initiative to do this job. So, like, all the lying he did actually helps him get the job. So he's selling this, you know, basically this junk to people, just cold calling people. And I like the, I like how they show that, how intrusive these calls are, really. Like, and that's part of the satire, right? Like, of course, his call, he's not in there in the room while you're having sex taking a call. But that's exactly what that call feels like, right? And so every time he makes a call, he's in this person's room. He's trying to talk to these people. And it shows you how silly a lot of this thing. They tell him to stick to the script. This woman, he calls this one woman, and the woman is like, oh, my husband died, and blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, oh, my God, what do I do with this one? And he finds a thing on the script that says, well, it's interesting you talk about that because we have this product and everything. And she's like, just hangs up on him. But he quickly comes to realize that he may not be able to sell his stuff because he's not using a white voice. This is the first one, like one of the big reveals of this movie of having to use a white voice. Danny Glover is in here, and I, from what I understand, there's a point where he says, I'm too old for this shit, and Boots Riley did not write this with Danny Glover in mind and forgot that line in there, so it ended up being a fun Lethal Weapon callback, even though it wasn't supposed to be. But anyway, Danny Glover tells him he needs to start using your white voice, and this is something that I've heard quite a bit, that black people have to use different voices in places, in different situations and everything. So this is one where he's using it to sell things. He has to basically not be himself to sell things. And after a while he becomes very good at it because he's got this white voice and he's got a natural salesman ability. The white voice is played by David Cross, It's just really funny seeing David Cross's voice come out of Lakeith Stanfield, and everything. And later on, there's another salesman that has Patton Oswalt's voice that comes out. But, the whole goal of this thing is to try to become this mega caller or whatever, the super caller or whatever it is, to make the real money. You can go up in your own, like, just like this elevator that's like a living room almost, and go up to this higher floor and sell this mystery thing that nobody really knows what they're selling up there, but that's where you make the real money. Conflict of this, though, is that he's getting good at this and he's being noticed, while the workers down on the ground want to form a union. They feel like they're being shit on, and of course they are. They're being shit on. Mm-hmm. Steven Yeun, who you might remember from Minari, is the mm-hmm. guy who's running this, who's leading this charge to get a bunch of people to unionize, put their phones down at 20 minutes and not make this company any money. Called Regal View is their name. But he's getting good at it, and like there's a conflict because we want to make sure that the workers get what they want, but at the same time he's about to be promoted, and so it causes a rift between he and his friends, leading to one of the best scenes of the movie, by the way, where Lakeith Stanfield says, "I'm with you guys. You know, I'm just doing it from the sideline. What I'm doing up here has nothing to do with what you guys are doing down there." And his buddy, this is what leads to that thing where they try to top each other with politeness, but it's definitely more mean than usual or whatever. And he's like, yeah. "I hope you have a nice day." And he's like, "I hope you have a nice day. I hope you have a nice day. I hope you have a great week." And he's like, "I hope your months are filled with beautiful days or whatever." And they just keep trying to top all that, and then they're like, "I was like, you know what? I think we should go to the bar and get a drink. How about two drinks? No, three drinks." They get all the way up to 10 drinks. It's one of my favorite scenes of like the past 10 years, probably, that trying to top each other with the politeness. But yeah, when he to sort of put a button on it and then figure out what you thought about this movie. When he gets called up to the super caller status, he finds out that this is about selling people. He mm-hmm. is selling slaves. There is this company called Worry Free, which is housing their employees at the place that they work and doing commercials that are like, "Hey, look at this life you can have. Basically living with six other people and having children with everybody." Like, it's just having children in those circumstances. You know, you are always going to be at this place working and living for no wage. It's basically in return, you get a roof over your head. That's basically all it is. And the things that they're, you know, the first one he has to do is something like, was it a phone company or something like that? I can't remember what it was, but it's basically selling off free human labor to help this phone company crush this other phone company, who have to pay for their employees, those dumbasses. So anyway, what did you think about this movie?
I believe I said last week that I had seen this movie once.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, I had seen half of this movie once.
Okay.
What I want to say most is that this movie fucked with my head. And I see immense artistry and craftsmanship at work here. Mm-hmm. I really, really do.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think its messages get a little muddied by the end because it's saying so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But man, it's audacious, and I absolutely applaud it for daring to do almost all the things it does to do. God, there's so much going on here. I think that's elevator password, where the girl types in like 75 different numbers.
Yeah, there's a point where she's almost done, and it's like more buttons than she already pressed.
there's a little Zucker Brothers in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of the, you know, airplane goofiness in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably my single favorite gag. I probably laughed more at that than any other moment in the movie because it just keeps going. You think, oh, 25 buttons is probably enough to make this joke. But I bet she presses 75 or 100 different buttons. It just keeps going.
Meanwhile, you have the elevator voice is played by Rosario Dawson. That's another fun little thing. Yeah,
I think it's fascinating. This movie has two main messages, I think. Poverty versus wealth, like you were talking about. And then I think it's trying to say a lot about race, too. And I guess that's maybe where it gets muddled for me, is that it ends up taking a wild left turn into horse people country that is entertaining, but really basically pushes the racial themes to the side for the most part and ends with the rich people fucking suck and probably always will. I did not see the horse people coming, I've got to admit. No matter how much wild shit they threw at me, the first two thirds of that movie, I thought for sure he was on drugs, like the cocaine he had snorted was fucking with him and he was hallucinating for a good 5 minutes. I was like, well, when's he going to come out of this drug trip? It's not a drug trip. They're half horse, half people. But I do think it almost has to be this wild in many ways, because there's so many movies that are less, that are more subtle, that have come before to make some of these same points, but not from this guy's perspective. I liked it. I don't know if I enjoyed it enough to say I love it and I want to watch it over and over, but I do want to watch it again, because there's, like you said, there's so much going on. I don't think it's possible to take it all in on just one viewing. It blows my mind that this and Blindspotting were shooting in Oakland at the same time.
Yeah, I know.
It's just two masterworks, two, you know, young directors going, I'm going to do what I want, and it's probably going to work.
Yeah. I was with you on that, with the Equisapiens that show up towards the end. It's always the moment in the movie where either you're like, okay, now I'm going to check out, or it's the moment where you try to, if you're with it, and it took me a couple viewings to be with it, by the way. I'm going to struggle trying to come up with words here, but I think when you look in a satire world like this, satire is always putting a mirror up to society and distorting it in some way, right? When you look at Onion headlines, you see something where it's like, oh, that's just a little bit too far from where we're at, but it still seems within reason that that's something that could happen. Like, that's how close things are in the Onion a lot of times. This one, I think the message is basically saying, yes, this is completely and totally ridiculous that somebody would have people snort cocaine that would turn them into horse people, and it makes them a stronger workforce that will help us out. But I kept thinking about that and thinking about it and ending up on the idea that while that is completely out there, just imagine if rich people could do that to other people. Don't you think that the groundwork is laid that they could get away with it? That's the kind of thing that I think about when I see something like this. Yes, this is visually, this is hard to take, right? You see all these horse people and everything in the bathroom, and they're like in pain and but especially when Armie Hammer tells him what the plan is, where it's like, we're going to have this we're going to have these Equisapiens as our workforce. They're stronger than humans. They can do more than humans can. And we want you to be the Martin Luther King of this group. Basically saying, we already know this is fucked up. We already know that this is going to cause problems to society. Why don't we have somebody who's out there rising against this that we can control? I'm floored by the message that that sends. And in the end, as ridiculous and as hard to accept that stuff is at the end, I feel like it's exactly where it needed to go. Like, at this point, maybe I am just drinking the movie's Kool-Aid and everything. It took me a while to be on board with this, right? Because it's a hard thing to get past. Movie's been kind of funny and little Zucker brothery at times, and then all of a sudden they throw horse people at you, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's what the movie's message is that, yes, we have gotten to the point where wealthy people can do whatever the fuck they want, and we're going to be okay with it because people are making money in the end.
He even exposes them and goes on a 24-hour news jamboree exposing the horse people with this secret video, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says at the end, I just told everybody everything and they don't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And that hit home for me because this was made in 2017, well before the pandemic, but this felt very prescient for me when he was like, you can show the people this horrible, awful truth and they just don't care. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So not only can rich people do whatever the hell they want, but it's almost impossible for us to empathize with other people anymore. I thought one of the most telling things the movie had to say was that they wanted him to have a white voice at the office, but at the party, they wanted him to act black.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah.
And the sequence where he tries to rap and then goes into
something we can't talk about,
but his face, because at first he's like, yeah, I got him now. But then I think he starts to realize, whoa, what have I done? I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I guess for me, maybe multiple viewings will help. I was expecting the punch at the end to be more racially based in terms of themes like Blindspotting, where it veers more into the class elements. Although race and class are kind of intermixed in this country. Maybe he's saying both at the same time. It is a movie that I can't get my head around, so it demands another viewing. But I definitely didn't have a bad time.
I think that creating a whole new race to oppress is definitely saying what you're saying there.
That's true. I didn't think about it from that angle.
It's almost like just enough is never enough with these people and everything. I love the chat, by the way. There's a lot of stuff here that's being talked about that we don't usually go too much into chat, but this movie has definitely got a lot of people talking. Like one, Abina says, I think it makes the point that people who exploit race as employers are going to exploit people even when race isn't a factor. And yes, it's turning poor, unsuspecting into an exploited workforce. You know, the other thing, the game show is brought up in this, the one where you get they kick the shit out of you or whatever. And that's entertainment. It's kind of like the Ow My Balls and Idiocracy and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It shows him at first just getting beaten up. I don't think it's I don't think it's by accident, by three white dudes he's getting beat up by in that scene. Also, he can tell his story. He gets beat up, and the next thing cuts to him, he's covered in shit. He finally is able to, and he's only known at this point as the guy who's walking through a crowd and this woman throws something at him and hits his head. He wears that bandage forever, by the way. It's bleeding through. That's something that I don't know why that is in the movie yet, like why he keeps wearing that bandage and has that blood seeping through it the whole time. There was a point where I was thinking, just like you, the cocaine and maybe he's just tripping and everything. Maybe he gets hit in the head and then he dreams the rest of this or whatever. But that's the only thing I could think of. But the other point you brought up, there's so many ideas being thrown out at one time in this. I think sometimes there's some that are not developed, and like there's just so many things going on. We're like, oh, you're going a direction with this, but I don't know where that ends up. Like, there's a point where my mind is going in a million different directions right now. But like Steven Yeun, at one point, he is shown as the guy who's trying to work for the common man in this. But there's this odd speech where he's like, we want to get free medical from our employers so that we can treat the gonorrhea and the chlamydia, stuff that you just found out about on WebMD. And like, why is he being ridiculed at this point? Because he's the guy who's, you know, he's the guy fighting for the common man in this. So why are we trying to find failings in him? That was one thing that was really weird about this. But going back to the game show, this is another part of that theme of this thing. Everybody in this is hustling in some way to try to make a living or be popular or whatever. Being on this show where you just humiliate yourself or just get physically beaten to get what you want. Even Tessa Thompson as an artist, even though her art seems like it's not a sellout type of thing, it's kind of a sellout kind of thing, because she goes in and she's using a white voice to talk to all the, like, maybe the potential financial backers of this thing. And then her whole show is reciting words from, what's the movie? Oh my God, I can't remember the movie. She keeps reciting the words from that movie. Gah, someone's going to be able to come up with it. The Last Dragon. It's The Last Dragon. She keeps on saying that same word from The Last Dragon. And people just throwing stuff at her the whole time. She's basically naked except for like two hands over her boobs and one over her crotch. And they're just people just throwing stuff at her. And this is another just a part of the humiliation that you have to go through to make a living in this. And meanwhile, she's also spinning signs out on the sidewalk and stuff like that. You just see all this stuff that all the stuff that people have to go through just to make a living is insane in this. And I think everything builds up to that, where like just and every time you think that you're on a new level, like when Lakeith Stanfield thinks that he's on a new level, that he's hit a point that's the top, he just finds out that he's not the top. He never will be the top, because these Army Hammers of the world are always going to be the ones controlling things.
I think I want to dig in the next time I watch it. I want to dig into a lot of the stuff that I just noticed, but I don't know what it was saying. Like, her sign twirling is very interesting to me, because she's twirling, at one point she's twirling a sign outside of what looks like, it says Discount Market above it. It looks like basically a convenience store. Mm-hmm. Those places don't hire sign twirlers in real life. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the movie is saying something about her being there. At one point, she's twirling a sign that says signs in front of a store called Signs.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know if that's just supposed to be funny, like the buttons on the elevator, or if there's a deeper meaning there. It feels like there's a deeper intent there, just because there's so much depth to the other parts of this movie. But then it's stuff like that Steven Yeun joke where the crowd is reacting, and then he says the gonorrhea thing, and they're like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
And he awkwardly goes, oh, we've got power to the people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I mean, that joke felt like it belonged in a different movie.
It
or
does.
For a different character.
There, that is one misfire in this, for sure.
I love all the stuff about meme culture and how sorry, bitch, have a cola or whatever the phrase is. Where the woman that originally hit him in the head, that video goes viral. She becomes a viral star, releases a song about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, he sees people are buying and wearing wigs.
Yes.
With cola cans attached to them. He's saying something with all of that. That's intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not sure if it's as simple as, you know, we care more about memes than we do the workers. And maybe that simple.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot going on in this movie, and I feel like it's hard for me to really know what it's saying.
Well, I took that as a cultural appropriation thing, that whole putting on the wig and putting the Coke can in it and everything. Because it was all white people who put on the wig and had the Coke can in there. That's sort of what I took from that. But you're right. There's also the part that is the meme part of it, too. So, like, you know, is it really the meme or is it the cultural appropriation? Is it both? A lot of that kind of gets mixed into what has, like, a lot of ideas going on.
Her earrings, I feel like her earrings are really important because they keep getting commented on, and every time we see her, they're big and have a different phrase mm-hmm. on them. And I feel like that's more than just a sight gag. I feel like this movie is an onion, man, and
yeah.
I gotta peel it. Yeah, feel it some more.
This is something that this is a movie that I wish I could sit down with Boots Riley and talk about this for like 3 hours and just dissect every section of this. That's how much is going on in this movie. It's not long either. We've talked about a whole bunch of stuff that happens in this, and it's not a long movie by any stretch.
No.
But it's packed. It is packed full. There's not a minute wasted in this. So, anyway, I am hoping that it looks like most of the chat really enjoyed this and at least has a lot to say about it more than our average one that we come up with.
Yeah.
I kind of hope this movie gets more into the forefront and more people dissect it over the years and more things can be found from this. Cause it's one of those type of movies. It's not perfect, but it's certainly something that's going to have you thinking for a really long time afterwards. So
yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely glad that you brought it up, brought it into my life, even though I did pause it, and say what the fuck about 17 times in a row.
It is one of those movies.
Continued watching. All right, so should we move into the double feature of the week?
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Yeah, I'll be very interested to hear what your double feature is on this one.
You should be, because this is next to impossible.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way to double feature this with a movie that is like this movie. Okay? In terms of the wild satire and the horse people, as well as the social commentary, if I wanted to go with the satire angle, you brought it up earlier, Idiocracy would be a really good one to go to.
Mm-hmm.
The similarity of the game shows, the similarity of the cluelessness of the average people to what's happening above them. There were some moments early on that, before the movie got truly weird, I was thinking Office Space might be the contender.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about Black Klansman a little bit.
Okay.
Because I do think there's a similar...
He's trying to sell himself, basically. Yeah.
I think that could... I also thought about Downsizing in terms
yeah,
of...
Yeah, Downsizing, that's not definitely.
Not a great film, but in terms of wild, big swing satire
mm-hmm.
With social commentary, I'm going to settle on perhaps a predictable Get Out.
Okay.
which also has Lakeith Stanfield in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of what people in power, in this in Get Out instance, white people, would do if they actually could get away with it
mm-hmm.
At the expense of black people. I got a lot of Get Out vibes at various moments throughout this film.
Definitely.
They're not tonally the same at all, but thematically, I think they're compatible.
They both have a scientific process by which someone becomes someone else, basically.
Yeah.
And then
they're not themselves anymore. They're used by a rich, powerful white guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Looks like, let's see, do we have any suggestions? Oh, Downsizing. Somebody gave some points to Downsizing.
Yeah.
So, that would be my double feature, would be Get Out. I think you almost demand a roundtable discussion after completing both films.
Yeah.
So that everybody learns something before they go home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. And now I need to give you homework for next week. And I have decided to make everybody watch Michael Clayton.
Michael Clayton!
This is a 2007 George Clooney dramatic thriller. It is on Netflix. And it looks like you can rent it from any of the other usual places. This has some depth to it. This has some commentary, but it's mostly a character study, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorite movies, and I think Chris knows and likes this movie as well.
This movie is great.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, this is the first time I ever really was introduced to clapping in the theater, which I do not endorse. I'm not a big fan of clapping in the theater. But there is a scene in this, and I think you know which one I'm thinking of, that
yes.
The whole audience just ripped up into applause during and everything. This is that type of a movie. Tony Gilroy.
Tony Gilroy.
Yeah, it's Tony Gilroy did this one. I think that's his name, right?
Tony Gilroy is listed as the writer and director.
So okay, yeah. good. But yeah, this is a really good movie. I can't wait to look at it again. The last time I saw this was probably not too long ago. It was last year, I think I saw this. Anyway, yeah, be looking forward to revisiting this. It's funny, also pay attention to the final scene, because the very final scene of this movie, because they filmed it without, I think they filmed this and there were all sorts of like people who didn't know a movie was being filmed. And so Clooney's reaction at the end of this movie is kind of like, you think you know what it is, what it's all about, but he's reacting to the people who are like basically saying, "Hey, Clooney," or whatever, something to him. So, this is good stuff. I can't wait to see it again.
All right. Awesome. You have your homework. We still have a few minutes for some questions.
Okay.
Several left over from last week. So let's try to get through some of these.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Whose filmography do you think you have seen the most of?
Okay. Well, going to go out on a not so precarious limb and say, as far as actors are concerned, Samuel L. Jackson. I've probably seen more Samuel L. Jackson than any other actor. When you think of all the huge actors out there who come out with their, you know, their big movie per year or every couple of years, like DiCaprio or Brad Pitt or somebody like that, they aren't in nearly enough movies to touch Samuel L. Jackson as far as actors.
Right.
Like if I went through his filmography, there's probably more that I've missed than I've seen. And I've still seen a ton. That's how his filmography is. As far as directors are concerned, it's Steven Spielberg all the way. There's I've seen every one of his features, every single one of them. There's hasn't been one I've missed. That's how big of a director Spielberg is. So I've even seen a lot of the shitty ones he came out with in that last decade or so. So yeah.
I choose to interpret this question Jeremy style.
Okay.
Which is to say, I'm going to go with Matt Damon, because between the Bourne movies and Interstellar and The Martian, I've probably seen those movies 200 times.
Okay. So not, you're talking
not
about
percentage not of filmography, but yeah.
Okay.
How many times I've seen his work.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to interpret it different just to be weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know how I do.
Yeah.
All right, let's see who else we got here. Let's see, Sam Jackson was mentioned. Spielberg, of course. MCU, of course. Indiana Jones. Oh, Indiana Jones for Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
He watches alone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. I saw in an interview where Edgar Wright was interviewing Christopher Nolan, which got me thinking, which two directors would you love to see co-direct a movie. By the way, you are inviting chaos by trying to do this, by just picking two directors and putting them together, but let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you come up with two great directors, you're going to have a clash of egos that are insane, right? Like, how do you let go? If you're, you know, what? I went ahead and just said full chaos. Let's do Quentin Tarantino and Martin Scorsese because that would be insane. Now, Tarantino has in the past collaborated with directors. He collaborated with Robert Rodriguez on Sin City. Well, Robert Rodriguez collaborated with Quentin Tarantino on Sin City because Tarantino directed that car scene in the movie. But he also. He also collaborated somewhat on the, well, I don't know if on the two individual movies of Grindhouse, it may have just been, I don't think they had input on each other's movies, but he collaborated before. So I imagine if Scorsese said something to the effect of, you know, I'm going to do this and you do that, he'd probably be cool. But like, I'm just sitting there thinking, what if Tarantino is like seeing a scene that Scorsese is directing and goes, no, we need to do it this way or whatever. But I want to see those two minds get together on some movie, somehow, some way. And even if they have to say, you do this stuff and I do that stuff, and then we edit it together, that's the way I want to see it. So,
There was a video going around Twitter last week from back in the day when Fiona Apple was dating Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, yeah, I saw this.
And she's at a table with Quentin Tarantino, and he's just Tarantino-ing, talking, and she just looks like her eyes are rolling back into the back of her head.
Oh,
I can't
imagine
Spielberg trying to be like, just shut up, Quentin. I want to get the shot locked.
Yeah.
I'm going with Gareth Evans from the Raid movies.
Okay.
And Sorkin Fincher. So we can have both kinetic fight scenes and kinetic arguing scenes, one that has both, where imagine the kitchen fight from The Raid with the crackling dialogue from A Few Good Men. You can't handle my fist!
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I see.
We got Scorsese and Taika Waititi.
Donald Glover and Jordan Peele. Christopher Nolan and Edgar Wright, which would be good. Spike Lee and Bong Joon-ho. Yeah.
Ooh.
That would be amazing. Coen Brothers and P.T. Anderson. Yeah, those are two. Yeah, for sure. I like all those. I mean, in general, I like the idea of any kind of mashup that you put out there just to see what you come out with, because that would be very interesting and fun.
Let's do one more final quick one.
Okay.
Before we say goodbye. This is based on a trending topic on Twitter from over the weekend. Gail Simone, who's a comics writer and an incredible Twitter follow, had asked everybody what their favorite punch was from a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I jumped into the thread to defend Back to the Future, and that was like the top voted reply immediately. It was Back to the Future punch.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Chris, what do you answer for your favorite punch in a movie?
Yeah, I saw this thread too, and I saw several that I really liked. I did not see, but I'm sure it was mentioned, the one that John Travolta does in Get Shorty. Where he's at a restaurant and he goes to get his coat and the coat's not there because they find out that, what's his name? Dennis Farina's taking it. He's taking the coat. And so Travolta, knows where Farina lives, and he goes to his apartment or house or something like that, knocks on the door. Farina opens the door and Travolta just punches him immediately as he opens the door, and then goes and gets his coat and then puts it on and then walks out while Farina's still like, oh my God, you broke my nose.
I love that movie. I'll go with there's a single punch in Batman v Superman.
When
Batman is kicking ass in that warehouse, where there is a henchman fully upright in front of Batman, and Batman's left hand comes in and hits him, and the dude just planks onto the ground. It's like a body slam punch. That scene remains one of my favorite Batman scenes ever. But I would probably pick that punch. There's probably a bunch that I could pick, but that's the one I'm picking today. We got Hulk in the Avengers. I guess that means punching Thor away.
Well, there's the it's Loki, when Loki's just sitting there and Hulk punches him.
I think he punches Loki and Thor humorously in that movie.
I don't know.
Well, there's a moment where they're like standing there and Thor's next to him and he just goes and punches Thor through the wall, but I don't know where that is in the
movie. I thought that was Loki for some reason. But that's probably Loki's... it. If it's Thor, then it's probably, yeah, that's the one that I'm thinking of where they're just standing there and he just punches him. Yeah. But it looks like, yeah, there's Tony Jaa and Ong Bak. Yep. Yep.
Ooh,
it's the first knee thrown. It's not a punch. It's a knee thrown. And then there's Clooney getting punched in Brother Where Art Thou. That's pretty funny. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Then there's Joe Pesci punches that dude, my cousin Vinny. Yeah, some good stuff there. So
good stuff.
Anyway. Yeah, next week is Michael Clayton. Folks, that's the homework. And once again, I'd like to thank the chat for coming in and discussing this movie today. It was a wild, it was like a, not wild, but man, there were people having opinions on this Sorry to Bother You today, and I really appreciated that today. It always adds more perspective to the movie you've watched. You watch a movie and you're like, I've got this down, this is what I think about this, and then other people come in with another perspective and you're like, oh yeah, that's another good way to think about it. So anyway, but yeah, thank you guys. We will see you next time. See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
So you're Rage Against the Machine, first night of the tour. They yell, abort the Supreme Court, and they update the lyrics of Killing in the Name. Second night of the tour, I don't know if you heard about this, last night, dude injures his leg, lead singer.
Yeah.
Has to leave the stage, comes back out, and sits on a monitor on the stage and says, I'm going to quote the news article, I don't know what happened to my leg right now, straight up, but you know what? We're going to keep this fucking shit going. I can crawl across this stage. We're going to play for you all tonight. And then when they were done, every band member hugged him and the crew came and carried him off like a king.
Nice.
So again, I say you are in for a treat, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of when I went to see Foo Fighters and Dave Grohl did it in a chair pretty much the whole time.
Oh, right, because he's broken his leg.
Yeah, which is something that apparently he got it from Axl Rose, who did the same thing for Guns N' Roses. So, I'm looking forward to that for sure.
They're going all over the world, dude. They're going to Poland and the Czech Republic. They're going everywhere.
Yeah.
Detroit. I'm going to have this clampy microphone I can pull down whenever I want, put it back up when I don't need it.
Yeah.
It'll look like it coming down out of the sky.
That'll be sweet.
That's great. Is he still in Montreal?
Mm-hmm.
So they had the first pick and they hosted the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any video of the first pick?
I haven't seen the video, but I know that they didn't pick the guy everybody wanted.
Right. They didn't pick the guy everybody wanted. The guy they picked is really good. And the audience reaction is just this. Oh, it's this amazing noise that can only mean complete shock.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not necessarily angry. They're not necessarily happy. They're just like, whoa, nobody saw that coming.
I remember when they got Ellie Tolvanen, that was the year after they went to the Stanley Cup and everything. And everybody was like, I can't believe Ellie Tolvanen fell this far. And now it's like, we're seeing flashes every once in a while of what he could be, but we think, we kind of know what he is at this point.
That's the thing with hockey players, man. It takes like 5 freaking years to even know.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have a Sidney Crosby, Connor McDavid type that comes along where there's really just no doubt. It's just a creps. It's like baseball. Baseball and hockey are both weird that way.
Yeah.
Football and basketball, you just get right to it. But there's something about those sports that require more. And it obviously is the case because you see players get better as they develop over the years. I remember when we first got Forsberg, we were like, oh, he's going to be a 40-goal scorer. And he was like a 19-goal scorer, and he still looked awesome, and he's gotten better and better.
Yeah, there was a period of time there when if you were following the Braves, it was like, oh, my God, look at this farm system. Like, like if you, during that period of time where they weren't winning all the time and they were just kind of scraping by or whatever, like the we could always look forward to the future, and it was like, here are the pitchers that they're going to have. They're going to have Julio Teheran. They're going to have Tommy Hansen. They're going to have all these people who are going to be anchoring the rotation for years, and then all these hitters that you would think we're talking about, like, oh my God. And then you'd find out like, oh, those are the top guys in our system. That's not really the top of the top in the minor leagues itself. Like a couple of guys would make the top 100, but not like the whole system or whatever. They came up and you're like, all right, we got Julio Teheran. We got Tommy Hansen. We got all these people. And they just never were great. Never. And got traded away or released or cut, whatever. Just never panned out.
Yeah, that's baseball. It's almost like a human stock market.
It kind of is.
I mean, it basically is, right? You're investing in the future potential of this person, and sometimes you bust out, and sometimes it's a big windfall.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed by that guy whose name I dare not pronounce who plays for the Angels, man. I just,
Shohei Ohtani?
Yes. I didn't know. I've never heard it pronounced. I only read it. But he's doing things that I didn't think as a kid were ever going to be possible in baseball.
Because
I remember hearing about Babe Ruth being a pitcher and a slugger. And it just felt like mythical.
Yeah.
And this guy's just got voted to the All-Star team for both. For both hitting and for pitching.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that there weren't more kids over the years who were sort of trained to be both. Like, a lot of great pitchers come out of high school, and they're the best athlete on the team, and they hit 400, and they hit 20 home runs or whatever it is in high school.
Yeah.
That's a lot. But then as, you know, the philosophy with all those guys was, we want you to be a great pitcher, and to be the great pitcher, you have to be focusing on that mostly. So we're going to take you away from the hitting. And not to say that there would be very many Shohei Ohtanis out there. It's not like there would be like, 10, 15 of those guys. That he's still rare even then. But yeah, there was some tweet. I can't remember the name the guy came up with. It's really funny, though. He's like, every day I'm reading something like, Mike Trout is doing this and that, and Shohei Ohtani has done something that hasn't been done since Jim Butterwings, Jameson back in 1922 or something like that, He's like a good pitcher, but I think every time I've ever, watched him pitch, that's his off night. Like he'll be coming off of some six innings shutout game or whatever, and then there'll be some national game focusing on him, and it's like, he's given up, he gives up like four or five runs in the first two innings.
Oh man, I saw a video on Twitter of him from a recent game, striking out. I don't know if it was three guys in a row, but the video was three strikeout pitches, three third strikes, and they were all kind of like sinkers. He looked good in that video, but yeah, it's like taking your car to the shop and it won't make the noise for the mechanic.
But yeah, the cool thing that they do nowadays, they can do, is they can show if there's a pitcher who's extraordinarily dominant, has like four different pitches, they can overlay their windup to where they show the release point and it's always the same. And then they show the pitch, the four pitches, and it starts off the same way, but each pitch goes and does a different thing. You just imagine being a hitter trying to hit this stuff, man, where you're just like, oh, that's the fastball. And then it just dives down into the ground.
I mean, the discipline to have that same release point.
Mm-hmm.
When I played Little League, as a 15-year-old, I was scared of 60-mile-an-hour pitches. Mm-hmm. I was stepping in the bucket and swinging and hoping for the best.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine facing 90-some-mile-an-hour, and then it actually this time turns out to be a 74-mile-an-hour hit-my-toe pitch, but yeah. I still swing at it.
Yeah. And there are, man, it's kind of getting a little scary. Aroldis Chapman threw an 106-mile-an-hour pitch a few years ago. And that was considered like, you know, an anomaly, like, cause even he is, even though he hits 100 regularly, 106 was ridiculous. And that's something that you can't just do with impunity. But now you're seeing relievers come out there. They're throwing 102, 103. And there's a guy coming out of the University of Tennessee who's getting all sorts of hype because he can throw 105 and 106. And it's like,
wow.
Man, I mean, just, you know, 95 used to be like an unbelievable speed. And then now they're getting 10 miles an hour faster than that. And, you know, people getting hit with that pitch, man, that's just going to be, that's going to be awful.
Like Bryce Harper.
Mm-hmm. He
got hit in the thumb and said, I'd rather get hit in the face because it won't break my face.
Right, right. Exactly. Exactly. Bryce Harper, talk about a guy, man, I hated that dude when he came up.
Yeah.
Hated him. And and part of it is because he was a young dude. He was 19. Yeah. He was an asshole.
Yeah, he was a hot shot.
And so, like, but now over the years, I've really grown to appreciate that dude. I think he's really awesome.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.